This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Joanne Gabbin is a poet, a teacher, a baby boomer, and a woman of color. I came to WMRA in 1999, just a couple of months after Joanne had established Furious Flower Poetry Center at JMU. How, I asked Baltimore-born Joanne Gabbin, did she ever get the powers that be to fund a poetry center?
I had class after class that loved poetry, and so I thought, why not bring some poets to Harrisonburg? And it just so happened that we wanted to honor Gwendolyn Brooks, and the poets just came. So she was the draw. But we had over 35 poets who came that year, and then audiences of 1,300 people at every reading. It was like being at a rock concert. And I was very happy that it went over so well, because I thought, with all this hard work, I'm not doing this again. But it just turned out that some of the younger poets who came, they said, you have to do this program again. And I started getting messages like that 3 years out, 5 years out. And I realized that in order to really be, I suppose, of concern for my fellow poets, that I couldn't ask them to come to a place like Harrisonburg more often than 10 years, every 10 years. So 2004, we did it again. And then in 2004, it was such an institution already that, to Limit Rose's credit, the president of JMU, of course, he allowed us to have a center for Furious Flower.
Which
so
means
that's how it happened.
He put money into poetry.
He put money into poetry. He was inspired by what he saw at the conference, and he just said, okay, it's time. And I was so, so pleased.
You talked about students responding to poetry and the audience at these poetry readings being as though you were at a rock concert.
Concert, yeah.
What do you think's going on with students and poetry?
Well, you know, I think what it is, I think children start with nursery rhymes, and they start thinking and expressing themselves that way. And I think when young people want to put down their private thoughts, they often do it in poetry or in verse. So when they get to college and they see that their courses in poetry, something that they are familiar with but something they have not shared, they get very excited. So it is really a venue through which they can express themselves. And we find that our creative writing courses at JMU are very, very popular because of that. It's a familiar form. And then to hear people who are not simply old, dead white men coming and reading his or her poetry in front of them, it's mind-blowing to them. So that's the reason we had students hanging off the balcony. I was really afraid someone was going to get hurt at the first Furious Flower Conference in 1994.
Where'd the name come from? Was it your idea?
Well, it was my idea, but it's not my phrase originally. It is Gwendolyn Brooks's phrase. It comes from her poem, The Second Sermon on the Warp Land. And the line goes like this. The time cracks into furious flower, lifts its face all unafraid, and sings in wicked grace. And when I read that, I thought, furious flower, because as it turns out, I simply wanted Gwendolyn Brooks to come and do a reading. This would have been her second time at JMU. But when the word got out that she was coming to do a reading, and we had almost a year to plan for a reading, people said, well, I'd like to come and see her and read with her. And then it turned into a conference. So it became larger than Gwendolyn Brooks. So I wanted to make sure that everyone knew that this poetry conference was going to be dedicated to Gwendolyn Brooks. So I named it Furious Flower. And when I thought about what the phrase meant, I realized that not only would I honor Gwendolyn Brooks, a furious flower, but I would honor the entire era of poetry in America from 1950 on, and call it furious flower, because that's what she was talking about. The time cracks into furious flower. At that particular point, our society was going through so many changes in terms of leaving segregation, going to integration, blacks leaving second-class citizenship, going into the full recognition of their rights. And it was a furious time in the sense that it was active, it was revolutionary. And she represented all of that. She was like the midwife that ushered in all of this activity, because she got the Pulitzer in 1950. And I think people started recognizing that there was Robert Frost, there was Carl Sandburg, but there was also Gwendolyn Brooks.
You are a woman of color who is a poet. Your life has been lived largely during this arc of change.
Yes.
Can you talk about your life experience as it has related to your own poetry?
Well, I have always loved literature. I think my mother started me with writing and reading. In fact, my mother, Jessie Smallwood Veal, was simply a woman who loved beauty. She was not an educated woman. I think she completed the fourth grade. But she used to go to the homes of white people and clean those homes. And she would look around and see what books their children were reading and see what they had. And she wanted to bring those things back to her children. So often I got hand-me-down books. I got those little red readers, you know, that talked about occupations, firemen, doctors, lawyers, teachers. And I read them from cover to cover from the time I was 4 until the time I was 7. And when my mother got me to the age 7 in terms of my reading, she said to me, "Joanne, I've taken you as far as I can take you. You need to go on from here." So she instilled in me a love of literature. And then there was this wonderful institution called Enoch Pratt Free Library in Baltimore, my hometown. And I was a constant visitor to that library. I remember one summer I read 273 books. So I started early loving literature, loving novels, poetry. And I found that, especially with poetry, when I got to be in college, that it was a way for me to express myself. And then I was introduced to poets like Langston Hughes, and in graduate school, Sterling Brown and Gwendolyn Brooks. So that's how it all started.
Poets of color.
Poets
who are expressing
of color.
Your experience.
My experience. In fact, my mother got very ill when I was finishing up my master's in 1970 at the University of Chicago. So I went home and found out that instead of being diagnosed with a slipped disc, that it was cancer. So I left school and I went home to Baltimore to be with her. And she lived for another 4 months. And that was just at the juncture when I had to decide whether I was going to go on through with the doctorate. So I read a poem by Sterling Brown called Sister Lou. And it was about a woman who was comforting another friend of hers, a woman friend, telling her, and she was dying, telling her how beautiful it was going to be in heaven. And so the woman was saying, "Go on up and talk to little Box Plunkin' David for a while. Get some of Martha's green grape jellies." And I thought to myself, here's this man, Sterling Brown, talking about heaven, talking about how it's going to be comforting, how it's going to be a place of peace. And when my mother died, that poem spoke to me. So, and so I said, I wanted to study this man. And at first, I wanted to do a comparison between Langston Hughes, a very popular urban poet, and Sterling Brown, a very popular rural poet, or the poet of rural people. And I got to meet him in 1972, and I decided right away that it was not going to be about both of them, but just about Sterling Brown. Because honestly, Sterling Brown read his poetry as though he'd written it the day before. And I was sitting there with Daisy Brown, his wife, looking at him read his poetry, and she looked as though she had heard it for the first time. It was a wonderful experience. And that was the literature. I said, if I did a dissertation, it would have to really mean something to me. And Sterling Brown's poetry meant something to me. That's when I became just such an advocate for African-American poetry and went on to do the dissertation. Later on, was able to publish the book in 1985. And that started me on my path. And interestingly enough, that was the same year that I came to JMU, 1985.
I think probably you're a little younger than I am, but we're you know, within
we're baby boomers.
Yeah, we're boomers.
Yeah.
There's this great documentation of your experience in the body of African-American poets' works. How can I, a WASP, broaden my own life from jumping into that work?
Well, it's really easy, and it's very easy to do in terms of the novels and the poetry that African-American writers have produced. I would say if you want to really understand the last 300 years of the African-American experience, you need to start with Toni Morrison. I read The Bluest Eye and her first novel, and I realized this woman is talking about me. This woman is talking about someone who does not have blonde hair and blue eyes, someone who wants to be considered beautiful but can only be seen often through eyes that compare her with the Shirley Temple image. So she let me understand that, yes, it is all right to be of dark skin and have brown eyes and black hair. And there, but she also pointed to the neuroses in our society concerning standards of beauty that really affect white women as well, because white women don't all look like Shirley Temple. But Shirley Temple and Marilyn Monroe were icons in our society in the 1940s and 50s. So she's talking about that particular period in The Bluest Eye. In her second novel, Sula, she talks about the friendship between two girls who grow to be women, and that friendship deepens. And I can never forget the last few lines of Sula and talking about the friendship. Sula is already dead, and Nell, the other main character, remembers the friendship, the deep friendship that she missed. And she says to herself, girl, 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 girl. And she was really remembering Sula. And I think the line is something like, there were circles and circles of sorrow. And then she talks in Jazz about the Great Migration and the Harlem Renaissance period. So many novels simply give us a historical background for the lives that we lived and the experiences that we had. And I think that, you know,
give you a history.
A history.
Gives you a history.
Yes. And it also gives me a cultural context that is valuable for me to drop my experiences in.
Poet Joanne Gabbin is founder of Furious Flower Poetry Center at JMU. She's also Baltimore-born during segregation, married, and a woman of color. We continue our discussion, begun before the break, about how all these things have informed her life.
Certainly, my life has been one of a transition from understanding that I was in a separate but also nurturing culture to moving into an integrated culture where people were not always nurturing. They were not always supportive. I remember that I almost didn't get to college because it was just assumed I was in a integrated high school, and we were about 20-30% of the population, the black girls. And it was April before anyone told the black girls about college. And so there was one man who was invited to come to Eastern High School from Morgan State College then, and he came and he told us that there were opportunities at Morgan, and we were excited, and all of us signed up, and we thought, well, this was the beginning of the admissions process. But it turns out that we never got to talk with counselors about college or where we could go. The University of Maryland wasn't open to us then. Towson State wasn't open. The colleges in the country were not easily accessible to Black girls, even good students. So I was very grateful when I ended up at Morgan State College. I stayed at home, went to school, but I decided that there was going to be nothing that stood in the way of my developing myself. So I became a person really interested in languages. I decided that I was going to be on the newspaper. I was going to be a writer. I went in there and I was a feature writer. The next year I was editor-in-chief. And I got so good at that, that the advisor for the newspaper said, the centennial of Morgan State College is coming up and we want you to be the yearbook editor. So I was editor-in-chief of the centennial edition of the yearbook. That led me, it's so interesting how little steps lead you in different paths, but I will never forget her. Her name was Frances Henderson. She was, in fact, the daughter of Carl Murphy, who was the founder of the Afro-American newspaper in Baltimore. So she said, we want you to work for us when you finish college. So I started my career as a journalist. And then I went on to be a public information specialist for the government. And then I realized that my real passion was for teaching. And so one day when I was in Chicago and I was working at the regional office of Social Security as a public information specialist, I made up my mind that I was going to go to graduate school. So I went to...
Now, wait. Yes. What about that day? What happened?
What happened that day?
Sounds like it was a very specific day.
It was. It really was. It was a very important day. My husband was already studying at the University of Chicago. I had moved from Baltimore to Chicago with him so he could get his MBA. And I realized that I had planned to go to graduate school even before he thought about graduate school. But because we got married 2 weeks after we graduated from college, I decided that marriage was important enough to me that I needed to see if that was going to work before I went off to graduate school. So I put off graduate school, as some women did, even though I had scholarships to grad school. But I said, it's my time. And so 2 years out, it was in 1969 when I decided I was going. So I went into the office of the Dean of Humanities at the University of Chicago.
Of Chicago.
Yes. And I simply said to her, I deserve to be here. Could you help? And her name was Catherine Hamm. She said, well, why don't you sit down? Let's have a cup of tea. And we had a cup of tea, and I told her about my experiences at Morgan State. I told her about my love of literature. And she said, I will see what we can do. And that was 1969. That was after the assassination of Martin Luther King, after the bombing of the four little girls in Birmingham, after Megger Evers. The nation had a debt to pay, and so I was part of that. I think she thought about that when she said, okay, I will talk with you. 4 weeks later, I had a trustee fellowship through the University of Chicago in literature and languages. That's how it happened for me. And still, I did not expect that I was going to be teaching at the college level. I wanted a master's so that I could teach high school English because I didn't want anybody to say that I was not qualified to teach these children. That was my reasoning. And then once I got there...
Would they be saying that because of your color?
No, it was, you know, once you started teaching, you have to do in-service.
Okay.
And so I just wanted to make sure that I was as qualified as I could be. That's an inheritance from my mom. My mom always said, just do more. And it was culturally known that in our society, Black people had to be better than white people to get the same jobs. That was a given. And so I just knew that I wanted to be better. I didn't want anyone questioning my qualifications to teach at the high school level. And it turns out that I've never taught at the high school level because I was so in love with what I was doing in school. I was a risk taker. I didn't care about a stupid question. And my professors were just thrilled that I was in it for the learning. Many of my classmates were, I suppose, they kept themselves from saying certain things. They wanted always to be safe.
Not risk takers,
because they wanted to make sure that they said the right thing so that the professor would say, I recommend this person to go on for the PhD. That wasn't in my purview. So interestingly enough.
Is that from your mother?
Yes. Yeah, sure. I really just thought, okay, I want to just have fun. I want to learn. I don't care if I don't know at this point Goethe. I don't care about that. I just want to learn. And as it turns out, at the end of the year that I did my master's, professors came to me and said, we want you in our PhD program. And I had the temerity to say, well, I won't come unless you have George Kent here permanently so I can study with him. And at that time, there wasn't a black professor on the faculty at the University of Chicago in literature and languages. That was the period of protests, of sit-ins. And so I went around with a petition to all the black students in other areas of the university and said to them, would you please sign this petition because I want George Kent to be given a full-time position with tenure, benefits, and everything at this university so he can be here to teach me. And they signed it. And I took that petition with 70 or 80 names to the English department and sat around with the other faculty. And do you know, he got that position. And I studied with him for the next, oh boy, I didn't finish until 1980. So for the next decade, I was studying with George Kent. And I'm so,
I want to stop you for one minute. And go back to something you said.
Yes.
You were talking about getting into Chicago and about the dean being mindful of the debt the American culture owed enterprising young persons of color.
Of color, yes.
And is that how you felt as an enterprising young person of color?
Well, I certainly had the feeling that these doors should be open. Mm-hmm. I said that there were so many sacrifices. That's what I meant when I said Medgar Evers and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. There were so many sacrifices made for people like me. So I was not going to be dismissive of those. I knew that I had a debt to them. So that's why I was there. And that's why I went to the University of Chicago. And interestingly enough, my advisor there at the University of Chicago really wondered why I was there, why I was doing well. Because interestingly enough, I came from a historically black school, Morgan State College. And I think the expectations were very low. So he asked
for your performance.
Yes. He asked me. He said, you're doing pretty well. How do you do that? And I said, I study. And that was it. So presumption was against me at the university. But I ended up being the first black woman to get a PhD from the University of Chicago in 55 years. There was only one before me. And it was, I think, in the 1930s.
You don't just teach other people about poetry. You write poetry. How does that come out of you?
Well, it comes out at different times. Most recently, I wrote a poem in memory of a friend of mine who passed just last week. Sometimes I will just write a poem like that to try to bring back that person in verse, in poetry, or to help those people who are grieving to remember. So poetry comes like that. Sometimes it's love poetry. I am married to a wonderful man, 45 years, and I often write love poetry. In fact, I did a poem that was on NPR called Love Sleep, and it embarrassed him a little bit, but, you know, I liked it. So it was fun. So I don't write all the time. I'm not like Sonia Sanchez or Nikki Giovanni, who have a set-aside time where they're writing poems. I haven't yet published a volume of poetry. I have poems in anthologies, in other people's collections, but I have not collected my own poetry. So I'm looking forward to doing that. I have probably about 70 poems, and I do want to publish them eventually. But my life has been spent, my professional life, promoting other people's writing. And I don't regret any of that time that I've done that, because I have turned so many people toward the writings of people like Gwendolyn Brooks and Rita Dove and Nikki Finney and Hakeem Adabuti and Amira Baraka. I know that people have read them because they read my books. They read my articles. They have come to my conferences. So I'm very, very gratified by the career that I've had. But I would like, in my waning years, to do my own book of poetry.
What are waning? I don't recognize the concept of waning years, but I do recognize that we will run out of time.
That's right.
What do poets give to the world that the world is richer for? What am I missing if I'm not reading poetry?
I think you're missing the vividness of nature. I think you're missing the depth of human emotion. I think you're missing wonderful characters that come out as persona in poems. You're certainly missing the wonderful rhythm and music that are so a part of poetry. It's wonderful to see children light up to a poem because of just the rhythm of it and the music that's there. I did a children's book called I Bet She Called Me Sugar Plum. And I love reading that poem to the children. It's a children's book that is a poem, but it's illustrated by a wonderful local artist, Margot Bergman. And it's just, if I have to say so myself, a beautiful book. But children love the pictures, but they also love the language. I think poets are the vanguards of our society. They see things and they can express things so clearly that we have a kind of head start to see what humanity is like, to see what our history will be, to see what the future is because of poets. All you have to do is listen to someone like Nikki Giovanni, who makes it so plain, talking about disappointment and loss, cotton candy on a rainy day. What an image is that, you know? Eating cotton candy on a rainy day. And my ancestors, those people who sang the blues, those people who wrote jazz music, they knew that the way you enrich your life is to bring music into it. And even when you're sad, even when you have the blues, that music will help you get through difficult times. I love this blues line. Sterling Brown introduced this blues line to me, and it's about a woman who's in love with a man, but the man might not be in love with her. And the line goes, I heard my daddy meaning my man, I heard my daddy calling some other woman's name. I know he don't mean me, but I'm gonna answer just the same. Now, can you imagine that kind of being smitten that much with someone and understanding that, okay, I'm not the one, but while I'm with him, I'm going to take advantage of it, you know? So that, you know, I love that.
I hear my daddy calling some other woman name. I hear my daddy calling some other woman name. I know he don't mean me, but I'm going to answer them.
I think the thing that separates poets from many people who don't write poetry is that they think deeply. They can synthesize what they're thinking about, what they're meditating on, what they're reflecting, and then put it into words. That's the gift that poets have. Lucille Clifton, she had that ability to concentrate language. In her poem, Won't You Celebrate With Me, she writes a poem in which she is reflecting on all of the difficulties she's had being a Black woman in America, all of the losses. And she finally says, won't you celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed. That's concentrated language, and it just gives me goosebumps. That's what poetry does for me. Someone says something in a way that touches you so deeply that your skin has to respond.
Joanne Gabbin is at it again next Tuesday at Virginia Tech, joining Maya Angelou and Nikki Giovanni in co-hosting Sheer Good Fortune, a celebration of Toni Morrison. Last time I checked, overflow seating was still available. Back after a break to talk with WMRA's Tom Graham about Tom Graham.